how much range you want out of it and whatever. Let me drop. Now, once you use an antenna tuner, you've now entered a very interesting world as far as discussions are concerned. You start discussing the word antenna tuner on 20 meters on a Saturday afternoon. Oh boy, you're going to get into some heated discussions 50% of the time. Because let's assume now you've got an antenna that's really a fairly high standing wave ratio antenna. You've made it too short, too long, whatever, and it's running a 20 to 1 standing wave ratio. And so of the power you put into it, your bird watt meter will say you've got 100 watts forward and 50 watts coming back. And you ask the average guy, 50 watts is coming back. My antenna tuner on the antenna side of the antenna tuner, my bird watt meter, tells me 100 forward and 50 watts. And you ask the guy, what does the antenna tuner do with the 50 watts? The transmitter, when you adjust the antenna tuner correctly, the transmitter sees a pure 50-ohm load, one-to-one visoir on the input end of the antenna tuner. The output end of the antenna tuner still sees the 20-to-1 visoir of your antenna. You haven't changed the visoir of the antenna for feed line. You've just changed, by way of the antenna tuner, what the transmitter sees. Let me drop. Now, there's about three or four ways you can describe that antenna tuner. A naive guy will say, it did an impedance matching process. It took that crazy impedance of my antenna plus transmission line, and it matched it to the transmitter, and the transmitter sees a 50-ohm resistive load. That's the truth. That's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is, while you were adjusting those knobs to get a perfect impedance match, you didn't know it, but you were creating exactly the right reflection coefficient on the output end of the antenna tuner, such that the 50 watts coming back from the antenna, because of its visoir, hit the output end of the antenna tuner, and got re-reflected forward, exactly in phase with the new signal that's coming out of the transmitter at this time, and those two signals added together. And that's the reason why, with 50 watts coming back, your antenna tuner, your bird watt meter on the output end, will see 150 watts apparent going forward, and 50 watts coming back. And the average guy at first says, what in the world is going on? I know my transmitter only produces 100 watts, and I'm seeing 150 watts on the output end of my antenna tuner. I see 100 watts on the input end. I see 150 watts on the output end. How can that be? Am I violating the laws of physics and conservation of energy? Absolutely not. Let me drop. Simply say 150 watts is hitting the transmitter, 50 watts is coming back, and the 50 watts is being reflected forward. So when you thought you were adjusting the impedance of your antenna tuner, you didn't know it, but you were making the apparent impedance of the output end of the antenna tuner, that magic number that itself presents a visoir to the transmission line, so that the signal from the transmission line coming back down hits the antenna tuner, gets re-reflected forward in phase with the signal now coming out of the transmitter. That's the second way of looking at the antenna tuner. What Lou came up with, the third way of looking at it is a time-based corrector. You know that your antenna, assume now for simplicity, the antenna tuner is mounted right at the antenna. And you know that the antenna, in the ideal world, when the antenna is electronically a half wavelength long, you're going to get 20 bounces. Okay. If you made the antenna too short, so if the visoir of the antenna is quite high, the Q is now, instead of 20, it's 200, and you're going to get something in the vicinity of 200 bounces, and you want those 200 bounces to be in step with each other. You want them to be all supporting each other. You want them to all be co-phase. When a third way of looking at that antenna tuner, according to Lou, is it is a time-based corrector. It is a kind of signal reflector that creates a delay, and that delay is such, or in advance, is creating a delay such that it keeps all of those bounces in step with each other. It's a time-based corrector. It's a timing corrector. That's a third way of looking at it. It's doing all of that simultaneously. Kind of magic. But more than half of the guys on 20 meters today will say, why the hell do you want to use an antenna tuner? It wastes power. Let me drop. And that example I'm giving, at least half of the guys on 20 meters today believe of the 50 watts reflected back, the transmitter doesn't see it. They believe the antenna tuner takes the 50 watts and throws it away. They are absolutely positive in their mind. It takes that power and wastes it. So therefore, they think that once you use an antenna tuner, you're wasting the 50 watts. However, you start asking them, okay, tell me about that 50 watts is wasting. How is it doing that? If the antenna tuner is well shielded, is it radiating the 50 watts? Absolutely not. Your antenna tuner is in a well shielded box. It's not wasting it by radiation. Okay. Is it turning it into heat? Well, you can put a thermometer in that box. And if the thermometer runs 70 degrees Fahrenheit in your 68 degree Fahrenheit room, there's no significant amount of heat being generated. It's not wasting the 50 watts by way of heat. Okay. So the 50 watts is coming back down the transmitter. Your bird watt meter is telling you the truth. It's really happening. 50 watts is coming back. And the antenna tuner is not radiating it. It's not turning it into heat. And it's not sending it to the transmitter. By the laws of conservation of energy, ain't nothing left. It's got to be re-reflecting it forward. There's no other way it could be throwing it away. And yet half the guys are positive it's throwing it away. And you try to convince them otherwise. Boy, you're going to be in a discussion for many hours, and you're probably going to lose. This is part of the information. So, time-based corrector, timing corrector, resonator, there's all kinds of things going on there simultaneously. The damn thing is magic. KE2EJ, K2LAW in the TechNet.
All right, Dick. Well, that's an interesting way of putting it. When I hear the word time-based corrector, I think of video. Sorry. Anyway, it's 9 o'clock if you want to get that last question and then move on to the mailbag. K2RIW, K2J.
Okay, there were only two guys who signed in with a question. A guy named Eric and a guy named Joe. Wes did say that he wants to have a discussion after Paul. So, we're almost on schedule, John, so let's go over to the mailbag. Did you get 283 emails this week? I hope they slowed down a little bit, because I don't know how the hell you keep up with all that. JC2WGB, the mailman. K2RAW in the TechNet. Go ahead, John.
JC2WGB. No, nowhere near it. Back to normal. The many emails that I received last week were due to your discussion with Eric. A lot of them had to do with the discussion of digital television. There was another thing that was discussed that took another majority. But I do have some interesting questions. And I'm glad you spoke about this topic at this time. Oh boy, perfect. I have a young hand with a question. Let me let it drop and I'll give you this question. Okay, now exactly what you were just talking about, the transmatch or the antenna tuner and the antenna. Okay, he understands all of that, and your description allows him to understand how it works. But he has a very basic question. If we have a perfect match, a one-to-one, and you say the signal bounces back and forth without a reflection coefficient, how is it bouncing? So if we have relatively perfect match, and we have 20 bounces, why? That's basically his question. Maybe you could help him out with that, Dick. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Also, Dick, the time is correct. I'm not sure if you're counting the effect.
When I'm being frank with you on this one, it means I've only got partial understanding of this one. That's the reason why I use this as a puzzle with my so-called antenna mavens. Let me drop it and I'll explain what I mean by that.
Dick, Wesley was doubling with you. I had turned it over to you and he jumped in, so I didn't hear any of your transmission except the last couple of words.
Okay. We know that if the antenna is electronically a half wavelength long, the resistive impedance you're going to see at the feed point of the antenna is something in the vicinity of 72 ohms of resistance and no reactance. And if you were using a 72 ohm open wire transmission line, zip code, so to speak. All the signal would flow down the antenna once, hit the antenna, and none of it would reflect back. We know that the signal, we know that the antenna demonstrates a Q of something like 20. There's about five definitions of Q. One of the definitions of Q is center frequency divided by bandwidth. You tune your transmitter higher in frequency until you hit a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. Measure that frequency. Tune it lower than the design frequency until you hit 2-to-1 standing wave ratio again. Look at the difference between those two. If you design the antenna for, say, 3.7 megacycles, 3.75, the dipole might hit 2-to-1 or 3-to-1 Viswa when you're at the upper end of the band, 4.0. It'll hit 2-to-1 Viswa again when you're at the lower end of the band, 3.5. So you've got roughly 500 kilohertz of bandwidth out of the antenna, out of a 3.7 meg center frequency. In that example I just gave, you would have something like a 7-to-1 standing wave ratio. I mean a 7-to-1 bandwidth ratio between bandwidth of 2-to-1 Viswa versus center frequency. You divide bandwidth into center frequency, it's one of the definitions of Q. The Q of any reasonable dipole, I've given a fairly poor example where it's only 7, it's going to be 10 or 20 in almost all cases. When the Q is that high, one of the definitions of the Q is, I just gave it to you, is frequency ratios, bandwidth divided into center frequency.
Repeater, timeout.
Another one of the definitions is voltage rise at resonance. Another one of the definitions of Q is current rise at resonance. Another one of the definitions of Q is energy stored per cycle versus energy dissipated per cycle. Another one of the definitions is rise time and fall time when you put a pulse into it. You calculate the Q by any one of those procedures, and you will, in any reasonable antenna, get the exact same Q 4 or 5 times in a row. So let's just talk about that first couple of ones, voltage rise at resonance or current rise at resonance. If your transmitter in your transmitting line is delivering 10 volts of sine wave to the antenna at this time, and the antenna has a Q of 10, that means the voltage rise is 10 times, somewhere in that antenna, the voltage will be 10 times higher. I just happen to know it's going to be a tips. If my antenna had a Q of 10, in this example I'm giving now, and I apply 10 volts to the antenna, and it will be a 72 ohm resistor, and I'm putting 10 volts into it, the tips of the antenna will have something like 100 volts on them. Somewhere in the antenna, close to the feed point, the current will be 10 times higher than the current flowing out of my transmission line. I could make the antenna out of one continuous piece of wire, where the right-hand side of the twin lead, the 72-ohm twin lead, the right-hand wire goes up the twin lead, makes a right-hand bend, and it becomes dipole. The left-hand wire goes up the left-hand side of the twin lead, makes a left-hand bend, and goes in the left-hand side of the dipole. I know exactly what voltage and current is flowing down the transmission line, 10 volts. And 10 volts across 72 ohms, I can easily calculate what is that, 7/10 of an ampere, something like that. You know what I mean. You know exactly what current and what voltage.
Repeater, timeout.
You know exactly what current and what voltage is flowing down the transmission line. Yet the antenna itself has higher voltage and higher current. All of that happens beyond that right-hand bend on the right side and then beyond the left-hand bend on the left side. And how does the antenna do that? It's conservation of energy. We know the energy supplied by the transmission line onto that dipole is launching real joules of energy. Watt-seconds, joules, BTUs, any units you want to use. Real energy is being launched. The energy travels down the wire. Something like 5% of it gets radiated on the way down to the tip of the wire. At the tip of the wire is an open circuit. The voltage reflects back, the energy reflects back, and it comes back to the feed point. The right-hand side is a quarter wavelength long. It took a quarter wavelength in time for the signal to go down there, a quarter wave for it to come back. It comes back out of phase. So the 10 volts I launch is going to come back like something like 9.5 volts out of phase. the 9.5 volt is going to partially cancel the 10 volts coming up the transmission line at this time, and that partial cancellation gives you a certain current, a certain voltage that you've applied, and therefore you calculate that as an impedance, and the impedance is going to be 72 ohms. How in the world can the voltage get higher? By the fact that the energy is bouncing back and forth. It's like putting energy into a flywheel or putting energy into the swing when you're swinging your child. In any one of these cases, you've got a resonant circuit. Let me drop. You've got a resonant circuit. It took you some significant number of cycles of pushing your child on the swing to get them up to full amplitude of swing. It took you a significant number of cycles on the push rod of a flywheel to get the flywheel spinning at full speed. It took a significant number of cycles of the signal coming out of your transmitter and transmission line to bring the dipole up to full signal strength on the dipole. Every dipole has a rise time. You think that you've turned on the transmitter on this nanosecond, and you think the very first cycle is going to see 72 ohms. Absolutely not. 100 cycles downrange, it'll settle down to 72 ohms. The very first cycle going into that dipole is going to see a much, much higher impedance, probably 1,000 ohms, because the signal didn't get a chance to go down to the end and reflect back out of phase. So by the craziness of this partial cancellation going on at the feed point, you see a much lower voltage, a much higher current. You and I call that an impedance, but there's a hell of a lot of energy bouncing back and forth. That higher energy bouncing back and forth, and all of those bounces because you're smart enough to make it resonate. Let me drop. Electronically, by way of your antenna tuner, or by way of the length of the dipole itself, you forced it into electronic resonance. Therefore, all those bounces are in step. But because it is a standing wave structure with some amount of real Q, it takes a real finite number of steps for you to build up that energy. Once you build up that energy, the energy within the dipole is a hell of a lot higher than what you've launched out of the transmission line in one cycle. Because of that buildup of current, that's the important one, if the antenna is running a Q of 20, the current in that antenna is 20 times higher than the current you've launched in the transmission line. That 20 times higher current is launching 20 times stronger magnetic field, and that magnetic field is the thing that's really doing the work to launch that signal into space, in my opinion. And you look inside of any of the computer modeling programs on antenna modeling, and you'll find that the vast majority of them will take your modeled antenna, break it up into a whole lot of little finite element pieces, and carefully calculate exactly how much current is flowing into each one of those pieces. It then stands off at a large distance in the program, calculates each one of those little segments of the antenna. Since you know the current flowing in that segment, you know the magnetic field flowing through that segment, and then it calculates how much of that signal, of that magnetic field, gets sensed by that remote sensing point for that particular portion of the antenna pattern that you're now modeling. It takes all of those individual little chunks of current, adds them all up, and that becomes the antenna pattern. It then moves to another particular point in space at some slightly different azimuth, where now all those points of current add up in a slightly different set of phase angles. That's how the signal is a little bit weaker when you're off a broadside, and that's how it builds up the antenna pattern. The modeling programs calculate the current of the cube, increase in current because of the Q. It calculates by finite elements all those individual little steps, adds them all up in a vector manner. In other words, it's adding up all the voltages with all of the phase angles to figure out what is the composite, and that's how it works. Current is what's doing it. Current magnification is what's doing it. The Q is giving you the current magnification. That's how the energy is bouncing back and forth, doing all this work that you and I call radiation. I strongly believe that is what is taking place. As you can tell, in my mind, I have built up a model. I have built up a mental model of what I think is working in the antenna. I'm not going to stake my life onto it that I'm absolutely positively correct. I've told you the model I use. For me, the model works. Using that model, I have filed 30 patents on antennas, 21 of them have already been granted. 6 of them are in full manufacture right now. So for me, it works. Like every other model, I guarantee there are portions of the model that are, have got some error. But the model seems to be good enough to do what I need. If you copy that model and use it yourself, I think you're going to get similar performance if you worry about all the fine details. That's a bunch of opinions. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet. Question.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. You know, it reminds me of studying reciprocating pumps, pumping against the head. It basically works almost the same. That's amazing. I'll let it drop, and unless you want to pick up Wes with a question.
Yeah, I think Wes has got a question on this. So wait for the four beeps, Wes, and go ahead with your question on this explanation. You got it, Wes.
Mr. Sugis, that's an extremely interesting subject. My question is, you put the power for the first time and you measure the first nanosecond. Can you speed up or slow down the process from the very beginning till the impedance match is established? Interesting.
I won't say it's impossible, Wes, but my gut feel is the answer is no. Very similar to, I'm pushing my son on a swing. And assuming I'm not Arnold Schwarzenegger, I've got a small amount of muscle power in my arms, and therefore it's going to take me 10 cycles of pushing in order to get him up to a significant amount of swing magnitude. That's the way every resonant circuit is. Every resonant circuit, the amount of stored energy per cycle is considerably greater than the amount of energy dissipated per cycle. And it takes you some finite number of cycles to build up the energy. So if I want my son to be swinging back and forth 10 feet forward and reverse, it's going to take me some number of cycles of pushing to get him up there. If I'm pushing a very heavy flywheel with a push rod, it's going to take me some number of cycles to get the flywheel up to full speed. Any resonant circuit that has stored energy, it takes you some number of cycles to get there. In the case of my automobile, to get my automobile up to 60 miles an hour, yes, I could do it all in third gear. But by using lower gears, I can get there a little bit faster. So yes, if I had a lower impedance push rod on the flywheel for the first few cycles, I could speed up the process a little bit. If I push my son with some kind of a longer lever arm on his swing, yes, the first couple of cycles I could get a little more energy in there than the way I normally do it. But can you get a 100-to-1 improvement by that? I doubt it. You can get a little bit of improvement. In the case of an antenna, because every reasonable antenna you and I use, let me drop it. Every reasonable antenna in a small number of nanoseconds, there is a real rise time, but the rise time tends to be very small compared to the usual data rate. Yes, if I'm trying to transmit the 40 megabits of data per second by the OC 382 standard, yeah, in that particular case, the rise time is going to give me grief. But when it comes to the usual data rate you and I send with voice communication, Morse code communication, the rise time is so minor to us, you don't worry about it. You don't go through a very elaborate process. But yes, I could switch in different switching networks, different impedance matching networks to bring the antenna up to rise time. I could make the rise time a little bit faster if I had very fast switching networks and I did the equivalent of gear switching. I could do gear shifting. I could do gear shifting and I could bring it up to resonance, full amplitude, a little bit faster. Is it worth all the effort? You see where I'm going on that one, Wes? N2XJN, K2RIW.
They do. But if you increase capacitive reactance and at the same time change the inductive reactance to keep the circuit in resonance, it's sort of puking, something like that. You can do it either by playing with the diffusion of the modulating signal over the carrier, or you can do it with just the electronic circuitry that would do it. The system is still in resonance, but you're keeping the energy stored in the capacitive part of the resonance circuit. Am I right or wrong?
If it was a full half-wave dipole, where in the steady state I see 72 ohms of resistive impedance and no reactance, and if I carefully study what's happening during the rise time, I'm seeing a much higher resistive component, because the signal didn't, the amplitude of the signal, the energy of the signal didn't get a chance to go down the wire and reflect back yet. So I see a resistive component that's much higher. I see a reactive component that's primarily an inductance. The first nanosecond of the very first cycle that drives my dipole, I'm going to pick numbers out of the air just to make the point, I think I'm going to see something like 2,000 ohms of resistance, and I'm going to see some number of nanohenries of inductance during the first cycle. The second cycle, the resistive component is going to come down, the reactive component is going to come down, and by the time I get to the 100th cycle, all of that crazy transient phenomena has died down, and I now see a pure 72 ohm resistance and no reactance when the antenna has come up to full amplitude, when the rise time is over with. But that first few cycles does see a crazy impedance. That crazy impedance is calculatable, deterministic, repeatable, and to live with that impedance like a gear-shifting automobile and store the energy into the antenna a little bit faster, you could do it. But now I'm taking maybe the barefoot antenna. Let me drop. The ordinary half-wave dipole, which is going to be 72 ohms in steady state, and it starts off at, let me pick a number, 600 ohms of resistance and 1,000 ohms of inductive reactance during the first cycle, I could impedance match during that first cycle and then switch in another circuit that impedance matches during the second cycle and switch in another circuit that impedance matches during the third cycle. And yes, I can get the stored energy into the antenna a little bit faster. And maybe the 50 nanoseconds of rise time, I can bring it down to 21 nanoseconds of rise time. It's all of that extra circuit and all of that extra switching network and all of the resistive losses of all that switching network, is it worth it? In most cases, I think the answer is no. Put it into your hip pocket to know that, yes, you could do it if your back's against the wall and you've got to make an improvement. But you're going to pay a heavy price, in my opinion. You're going to get a rather small amount of improvement for a whole lot of effort. But the real stored energy, let me drop.
Anybody out there, can I get a mobile radio check? Jupiter? We're connected right now to 9126 to the TechNet, the Limewalk repeater up on Long Island.
So, when the antenna comes up to full steady state, this is K2LAW, this is the technical net on Long Island, and this is TechNet number 1472 of the series that began 31 years ago. And we're discussing antennas, as you guys can tell. What I'm getting at is that when the antenna comes up to full steady state performance, there is no reactor, there is no inductor, so to speak, required in your antenna tuner. Your antenna tuner is nothing but a piece of 72 ohm transmission line going between your 72 ohm antenna and that dipole. All of the stored energy is in the dipole itself, the energy bouncing back and forth. You could, if you want to, relate that amount of stored energy into what looks like a kind of capacitor and a kind of inductor and a kind of radiation resistor. It is an LCR network as an equivalent diagram. And you make the right, you choose the right value of inductor, capacitor, and resistor, and as you sweep your transmitter, let me drop. As you sweep your transmitter a little bit above resonance and you start seeing an inductance, and you sweep it a little bit below resonance and you start seeing capacitance, and you go back to resonance and you see a resistance, you could make, for the near region of sweeping the antenna, you could make your chosen apparent inductor, apparent capacitor, and apparent radiation resistor, you could make your equivalent circuit match your real dipole when you don't go too far in frequency. As you start going real far in frequency, like 10% away, that simple diagram is going to break down, and you've got to go to a much, much more elaborate diagram. So is there stored energy in what looks like a capacitor, what looks like an inductor, and what looks like a radiation resistor? Yes, there is real stored energy. It's in the form of your joules of energy you've launched with that transmission line bouncing back and forth in the antenna. But is there a real capacitor there and a real inductor? Absolutely not. It's an equivalent circuit that in the near field of frequency, in the near region of frequency, it acts like there's an inductor and a capacitor there. It's not. It's nothing but a piece of wire and energy bouncing back and forth on that wire. And it's far from simple. We're trying to make it simple. By way of the tinkering experience that we amateurs have, it acts simple if you've got some experience. You try to take your fields and wave course given to you in college, and you try to boil those crazy Maxwell equations into a real working dipole, and you're going to lose a lot of sleep, and in my opinion, you're not going to come up with a very good answer. You're not going to be pleased with that approach, and that's not the way you're going to run your business if you're running an antenna company. Bunch of opinions there. KC2WGB, darn good question.
H-R-I-W
in the
TechNet.
Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Okay, Tim. Yeah, some good answers. I'm sure he understands a little bit more about what's going on. All right, I'll drop and I'll go on to the next question.
K4WAG calling from the Wellington, Florida repeater through Echo Link.
Want to take that, Dick?
Okay, that person, give me those call letters once again in your name, sir. K2RIW, Rio Indian Woman. Listening.
Kilo 4, Whiskey Alpha Golf, Boynton Beach, Florida. Echo Link.
Okay, Boynton Beach, Florida, K4 Whiskey Alpha Golf. What is your name, sir? And are you asking a question on this subject that's on the floor right now? Whiskey Alpha Golf, go ahead. K2RIW.
Yes, sir. My name is David, and the question I have, and I just caught the end of the of your net. Somebody checked into your net in Long Island. I was very fascinated. And my question is, those of us that use dipoles and G5RVs, things of the such, and antenna tuners, even though the antenna tuner makes the transmitter happy by seeing, a resonant circuit, is the efficiency of the antenna that is fully resonant has a better transmission than antennas that are multi-band with antenna tuners? So what I'm asking is, if you use an antenna that is resonant close to the frequency you're operating on, is it better than trying to use an antenna tuner?
Yeah, I think let me jump for a second. I think I see what you're asking, Dave. If this is the best of all worlds, we'd like all of our antennas on the frequency we were using it to be perfectly resonant, to give us a pure resistive impedance, and requiring no antenna tuner. If this is the best of all worlds, my antenna would be designed so that on each one of my favorite frequencies, on each one of the bands, my favorite frequency on 80 meters, my favorite frequency on 40 meters, my favorite frequency on 20 meters, and so on, the antenna would be a pure resistive impedance. It would be close to 50 ohms, and no antenna tuner would be required. In theory, if I work real hard, I can create that on at least one frequency on each band on a multi-band antenna. It's going to take you a lot of effort, and is the effort worth it? Every realistic antenna that you buy and build on many of the bands, it's going to be a significant standing wave ratio on some of the frequencies you care about on some of those bands, and you're going to use an antenna tuner. If the antenna tuner is built with any reasonable amount of quality, the antenna tuner is lossless. You put 100 watts into that antenna tuner, and 99 watts comes out of it and gets delivered to the antenna. And if your antenna has got reasonable components that are not lossy, of the 99% of the power hitting the antenna, 98% of it is going to be radiated into space. The antenna tuner does not waste power. Let me drop it. Lots and lots of people will put a Berg watt meter on the output end of the antenna tuner. They will see 150 watts going forward and 50 watts coming back, and they assume the antenna tuner takes the 50 watts coming back and throws it away. And I said earlier, the antenna tuner has to obey conservation of energy. It's got to obey the laws of physics. If it's a well-shielded box, it's not radiating that energy. If the antenna tuner is properly adjusted, it's giving a good impedance match, and none of that power goes back to the transmitter. If the antenna tuner is made out of reasonable good components, it is not dissipating the 50 watts in the case of turning it into heat. You can put a thermometer in that box and confirm it. So if the box is not radiating it because of the shielding, it's not dissipating it because of heat, and you can confirm it with a thermometer, there ain't nothing left. It's got to be re-reflecting the 50 watts forward, where the antenna gets another chance to re-radiate it. The worst thing that happens is that because the signal is now bouncing back and forth between the antenna tuner and the antenna, that's what your antenna tuner was doing. Oh, by the way, let me drop. Back in the old days when you had a Pi network on the output end of your transmitter, your 6146 tube and your DX100 transmitter from Heathkit ran into a real Pi network, which had a real large tuning range, and even though your antenna had a 4-to-1 Viswar, the Pi network tuned it, and you called it the output tuning network, the tuning and loading control of the Pi network, which was not in any way different from the antenna tuner you use today. We want compact transmitters, we want no-tuned transmitters, we want a compact box. They took away that Pi network we used to have, and now they sell it back to us by way of an antenna tuner. It's the exact same network. It doesn't waste power. The power is bouncing back and forth between your antenna tuner and the antenna, and now if your transmission line has got some loss because the signal is flowing through the transmission line 5 times instead of 1 time, you're getting some more loss of the transmission line. If you're smart enough to use low loss transmission line, you don't lose very much and you come out ahead. But the main complaint I was making is the antenna tuner, if it's built with quality components, does not waste power. I wonder if that helps someone, Dave. K4, Whiskey Alpha Golf, K2LIW in the Tech Minute. By the way, my name is Dick.
K4, Whiskey Alpha Golf, this is K4WAG, Boynton Beach, Florida. Yeah, thank you for the simple explanation. I'm a relatively new ham. I do have electronics background, and after looking on things on the net, your explanation was, I think, dead on, and I really appreciate your time. Back to net control.
Yeah, it turns out that when you talk about, for instance, the section of the QST magazine called The Doctor Is In, one of my favorite sections, and Joel Hallis has from time to time said that the antenna tuner will waste 10% of the power you put into it, and he is speaking from a very popular opinion. You can hear that opinion so darn many times on the air, it has become a kind of truth. Everyone believes it, no one checks into it. If you really measure the amount of heat in the box, you really measure the amount of power going in and the amount of power coming out, if you bought a reasonable brand of antenna tuner that's made out of good components, you're not going to get even 10% of loss, which would be, what, half a dB. You're not even going to get that much, in my opinion. Yes, you and I could make a super compact antenna tuner where the tuning and loading control and the inductor that's inside is made out of 18-gauge wire, and yes, I could make a very lossy one. It's very easy. There's a zillion ways I can make a lossy antenna tuner. But if the guy who designed it for you has got a reasonable... It's got a reasonable amount of pride. He didn't build it that way. It doesn't have to have loss. It can be as low as loss as the Pi network used to be on the transmitters we used for years and years before we insisted on these compact, no-tune transmitters that don't have a tuning network anymore, and now they sell the antenna tuning network back to us as a separate box. Let me drop. I'll give you one other example. An unscrupulous contractor building you a house, he takes this beautiful piece of virgin land that you bought, He scrapes away all the topsoil. He builds the house. Then he sells you back your topsoil. And he sells you back the landscaping that he scraped away, which was nice and convenient for him to move around his vehicles while he's building your house. And so that something along those lines has happened here. We naively insisted that we want our transmitters to be compact, and we want them to be no-tuned. Well, they gave us a compact transmitter with no tuning, but now they're selling us back the antenna tuner that used to be there. For years and years of the early days of ham radio, all of our transmitters had a tuning and loading control. We had a real Pi network output of that transmitter. It was a little bit more voluminous, but boy, it could adapt itself to a whole lot of different antennas. So we paid the price by our naive request as I see it. And so when you get the big picture, I think there's a little more understanding that can take place. What's your next question, John? KC2WGB, giving us the mailbag. K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, John.
KC2WGB, TechNet mailbag. Okay. All right. This gentleman asked the question 2 weeks ago about sensitivity and measuring it and how to do it. And you gave him a pretty good dissertation on that. Now his question is selectivity. How is that test done? And is it something he would be able to do with simple equipment? He's not telling me what he has. But, and also, he likes the verbose answers, Dick. You don't need to take your time explaining it to him. All right, back over to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
My goodness. Wait a minute. I have to ask you, Eric, why every so often I get a much lower audio if I don't wait for another level of beep in the standby. Something else in the system has to reset. What was that again, Eric?
I said I'll give you an answer. The reason why that happened, it drops by 6 dB. Just like just a moment ago you were waiting. Somebody was keyed up on the IOLP, so you're going to have audio coming from you and just some hum coming from another input. When two signals come together, one gets muted by 6 dB. There's your answer.
Well done, Eric, and I'm a little bit smarter. Let's see now. The subject matter here is the measurement of selectivity. Without a doubt, if you've got a medium good quality signal generator nowadays, which has got a frequency synthesizer to it, and by the way, selectivity has got a number of different definitions. I could be talking about the selectivity of the IF strip of the receiver. I could be talking about the selectivity of the RF front end of the receiver. But by, say for instance, I've tuned the receiver to, in my example, 144 megacycles, and I've set the signal generator on 144 megacycles. I've measured either the sensitivity or I've measured some specific amount of response. The specific amount of response might be what signal strength level is required out of the signal generator for the signal strength meter on the receiver to read S9. That's a possible datum point, so to speak, a reference point. So I turn up the signal generator. I make sure the receiver is really tuned to the exact same frequency of the signal generator. I turn up the signal generator until I get an S9 signal strength report on the signal strength meter of the receiver, and I write down what is the setting on the signal generator, either in dBm, microvolts, whatever units you like. And then I start stepping the signal generator 100 hertz at a time, 10 hertz at a time, 1 kilohertz at a time, whichever. I start stepping it up in frequency, down in frequency, and I remeasure how much dial setting is required to bring the signal strength meter on the receiver back to S9. And now I plot that curve, and it's going to be a bathtub-shaped curve. In other words, the signal will be weakest in the center, and as I start walking down the skirts of the IF strip of that receiver, I'll notice that it requires
repeater timeout.
I'll notice that it requires a stronger and stronger signal to get the same amount of S meter response as I walk away. And when I look at that curve will be the selectivity curve probably of the IF strip of that receiver. That's one way of measuring selectivity. And I could now dial in the 3KC bandwidth filter. In other words, my receiver has got some knobs or switches on the front panel where I could dial in different bandwidth filters. I might have a CW filter that's rated for 500 hertz of bandwidth, and I could do the exact same performance requirement again. In order to really make this requirement, this measurement meaningful, it better be a synthesized signal generator. If you try to do that with a Hewlett-Packard 608 signal generator, the good news about a Hewlett-Packard 608, it is probably a 1955 design from Hewlett-Packard. In its day, it was an extremely good signal generator. And nowadays, on the surplus market, you could probably pick one up for $50, maybe even $30 in some cases, in good working order. Let me drop. It's got a beautiful dial on the front end. It's got a beautiful piston attenuator, very accurately calibrated in microvolts or in dBm. That's the good news. The bad news is it is not a frequency synthesized signal generator. By modern day standards, it's called a driftometer, a driftometer. If you let it warm up for about 5 hours, it might be steady enough in frequency where you could do some of those measurements. But under normal circumstances, as your power company goes up and down in power output, as the wind blows across your bench because you're moving around in the room or you've got a window that's open, the signal generator can easily drift a couple of kilohertz up and down over a 5 minute period. And if you're trying to make measurements on a 500 hertz filter and you're trying to move the signal generator 10 or 50 hertz at a time, and the signal generator is drifting by 5 kilohertz, it's going to drive you up a wall. So that free-running oscillator inside that signal generator is not steady enough in frequency response that you could easily do this measurement of the IF strip. A modern-day frequency synthesized signal generator, you could probably dial it to the nearest 10 hertz, 50 hertz, or whatever, and because it's got a good reference oscillator inside, let me drop... It's got a good 10 megacycle crystal controlled temperature compensated reference oscillator inside for its frequency synthesizer. That thing could easily have a frequency stability that's in the couple of hertz category in a 10 minute period. That's the good news of a frequency synthesized signal generator. The bad news is you're going to pay a hell of a lot more money for it. You try to buy one of those in good working order, and you're probably going to pay closer to $1,000 for a used one. A brand new one, you could easily spend $5,000. My favorite signal generator is the one that has a free clock loop inside. Why can't I think of the model number of that one? You own a couple of them, John. Tell me the one that's got that free clock loop with a beautiful frequency counter built into it, Hewlett-Packard. Sometimes on the surplus market, you can buy one of those in good shape for around $400. Tell me the model number on that one, John. 86 or something or other. You got it, KC2WGB, K2LAW in the deck, man.
I don't know if you're talking about the 8640 and 41, those models, or if you're talking about the ones with the plug-in modules.
You hit it, John, 8640. The Hewlett-Packard 8640. It is not frequency synthesized per se, but it's got a very good frequency counter inside, and when you set it up in the correct mode, it becomes a frequency locked, not phase locked, frequency locked signal generator, and it will hold frequency to the nearest a few hundred hertz, or maybe even tens of hertz. It's got extremely high spectral purity output. I think it's got a pretty good power output setting set of knobs on it, and a very nice steady frequency. I believe the basic unit goes from something like 10 megahertz up to 512 megahertz, and with the frequency doubler circuit, it'll go to 1,024 megs, if I remember, and down to 10 megs. And I think it's got a power output setting set of dials on there, which I believe could allow you to do frequency sensitivity of a receiver. Is that true, John? You own one of those. So do I own one of them. But it's in the other end of the house right now. and it's not close enough for me to, and I haven't used it in the last year, so as you can tell, I'm a bit forgetful. So tell me, how good is the power output on that one? And I believe the frequency accuracy of that thing, the frequency drift, is very good. So tell us your impression of a Hewlett-Packard 8640, because I think on the surplus market you can now buy them for around $400-$500. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. Good guess. The price is roughly, for something working in fair condition, is about $600. And I believe it has 15 dBm on the output on that unit. And it is very stable, even though it's not process controlled. It's just frequency controlled. So, yeah, that beautiful unit. And there's a lot of those available. But they're a little more pricey.
Question. Well, hold on a minute, Weston. The 8640 does go to plus 15 dBm of output. What do you believe is the weakest signal approximately you'll put out? Will it go down to a microvolt minus 107 dBm by way of its front panel controls, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW?
I believe you're correct, Dick. I haven't worked with it for a while with all the new ones I have, but I believe that's correct. I think you can go down that low.
Okay, so when it comes to bang for the dollar, in medium good quality modern-day signal generators by which you could measure frequency sensitivity up to either 500 megs or 1,000 megs, depending on which version you got, and be able to measure selectivity by slowly frequency sweeping it up and down and knowing what frequency it's on, and it's got built-in modulation, it's got built-in amplitude modulation, frequency modulation, power output adjust, beautiful frequency counter, traceable to the bureau, and by way of its frequency lock loop, which is a very good way to go. Everybody thinks that the only way you can get a stable signal generator today is with a phase lock loop signal generator, which tend to be a hell of a lot more expensive and nowhere near as finely settable. That particular frequency lock loop of that Hewlett-Packard 8640, I believe you could move it 10 hertz at a time in a repeatable manner with its freak lock loop and its frequency counter and know exactly where it is.
I think it was 2 parts per million, Dick, if I remember correctly.
Okay, so it's got all the hair in its chest you want. It's a quality product by Hewlett-Packard. On the used market, even though brand new, I'm guessing it was around $5,000 or $8,000, and you can buy them around $600 today and occasionally $400, and the only complaint you're going to run into is it's kind of heavy. It's a really good-sized piece of equipment. It doesn't look like a portable signal generator. That's some of the really modern ones that are compact and it looks like. And one other problem it's got, let me drop. It's got some beautiful power supplies inside. When you open up the cabinet, each one of the individual voltages of each one of its voltage regulators has its own output testing port and a light-emitting diode to tell you that voltage is present. So if you need to do some troubleshooting, the thing has got a beautiful amount of maintainability built into it. That's the good news. The bad news is that it is a 1985 design, and as such, its tantalum capacitors do give you random failures. It's got a whole bunch of 1 microfarad and 5 microfarad, 35-volt, little bitty tantalum capacitors. And of the 30 tantalum capacitors that are in there, one of them is going to fail on you each year that you use it. The good news is that, the bad news is that it's got these failing tantalum capacitors. Each one of those capacitors, by the way, is 50 cents worth. And so to replace them is no big deal. And to find out the bad one, most of the time is not very difficult. You open up the cabinet and find out which one of the voltage regulators using those tantalum capacitors doesn't have a light-emitting diode that's lit on it, or you go to the test points and measure the voltage. And so troubleshooting is fairly easy, particularly if you've got the schematic diagram. Let me drop. As long as you go to the right website, the schematic diagram, the service manual, the service manual and the owner's manuals are online, free of charge. So you've got good instrument, you've got good documentation. You got damn good instrumentation. You got darn nice signal generating. It puts out one of the purest signals you're ever going to see out of a signal generator across that frequency range, 10 megs to 500, 10 megs to 1,000, and very settable and very accurate on its frequency counter. So except for a couple of minor glitches, you can't do any better, in my opinion. With that thing in your shop, you can make some fantastic receiver measurements with one exception. Let me drop.
A quick note, too.
And that is...
KC4UKC, I got a question as well.
The only problem is the weakest signal it could go to is probably in the vicinity of 1 microvolt or 0.5 microvolt. And therefore, if you want to make a signal, if you want to make a sensitivity measurement down to, say, minus 130 dBm, because you're measuring the Morse code capability of your 300 hertz or 500 hertz wide IF filter of your particular receiver, the signal generator won't go down that far. That's a minor problem, but there's ways around that. But in bang for the dollar, it's hard to equal that one. So now we've got three guys that want to ask further questions on this. I'm going to go to John, Wes, and the new guy in that order. KC2WGB, the first guy, K2RW. Go ahead, John.
All right. Very good, Dick. Also, as you know, Dick, it has plug-in cards. I happen to have all the extension cards to work on, but you really don't need them. And those boards are very easy to work on. They're not crammed. They're not multi-level. They're just straightforward, regular printed circuit boards. That thing is a pleasure to work on. Back to you, Dick.
Net tonight at 8 o'clock.
Yeah, as I said earlier, Hewlett Packard did a beautiful job on the rear design of that generator. They did a beautiful job on its maintainability, its repairability, the way it's got built-in tests where each one of its voltage regulators, there's about 5 of them in there, the voltage that comes out of it is clearly marked on that little printed circuit board. It's got test points where you can measure the voltage. It's got a potentiometer where you can set that voltage as accurate as you want. And it's got a light-emitting diode telling you the voltage is present or it's not present. So except for those tantalum capacitors that fail in there, because the tantalum capacitors are probably good for, let me pick a number, 20 years, and the machine is 35 years old. So randomly you're going to get some tantalum capacitor failures. Some people ignore the failures and say, I wait till it fails because nothing bad happens. It's the way the machine is built, it's got built-in protection for every one of those voltage regulators. When one of those tantalum capacitors becomes a short circuit, nothing bad happens. That voltage disappears, and one of the functions on the front panel is no longer there. In some cases, the power output is no longer there. And you do some troubleshooting, and it's inexpensive to do the repair. And if you know how to do signal tracing or voltage measurements with the schematic diagram on the service manual, finding the bad ones is quite easy. A really super conservative guy, let me drop. A super conservative guy will say, I want the signal generator to have perfect reliability from now on. I know that these tantalum capacitors are a little bit flaky after 20 years. I'm going to go in there and replace every one of those tantalum capacitors with a moderate capacitor. You could do that. It's quite a bit of work. I don't recommend it. Of the one that I own, I know that I'm going to get one of those capacitors failing per year. I know it takes me a half hour of my time to find the bad one, and I'm back on the air. Whereas if I want to replace every one of them, it's going to take me a couple of days of my time. Is that a good investment? It's your choice. Wes, you got a question on the 8640 signal generator. Go right ahead. And 2XJN, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Actually, I have a problem with the explanation of all the things. Like you say, okay, you want to measure the distance, so you take the ruler and you measure the distance, or you take the time of flight of the lighting, but you forget about the medium. At the same time, we might say that when you explain the performance of the radio receiver that responds only to the radio signals when it's tuned exactly to the frequency, you not necessarily mention that, well, it is also the sensitivity is about the nearby frequency or the broadcast station on adjacent channel to be attenuated. My problem really lies in the fact that you say, okay, you have a generator, and then you step down the demand of that frequency down or up, and then you measure your sensitivity.